What I'm going to present now is active hardware metering, which is a method to prevent piracy of hardware. And why hardware piracy is an important problem. Here, it's actually becoming more and more of a problem because the traditional business model of the IC industry has been transformed over the past 20, 25 years. So 25 years ago, most of the U.S. companies that were designing chips were fabricating them too. As technology is becoming more leading edge, it's becoming less and less the case. Most of the leading edge design companies nowadays are fabless. Here I'm showing a chart from SIA that has studied the percentage of the fabless companies in the U.S. industry, and we see that, for example, in 2002, it reached 16%. But of course, this is just all the microelectronic industry, and it's much more that the leading edge is almost 95% fabless nowadays. Essentially, the only companies that have their own fabs for the leading edge technology and that can afford it nowadays are Intel and Texas Instruments. IBM and a few other companies are sharing fabs, but they're actually going to not do that for starting the next technology. And TI just announced that their next technology is going to be fabricated all by TSMC. The cost of building a full-scale 65-nanometer fab is reaching $3 billion, and it's increasing by huge percentage every new technology comes. So it's becoming more and more of a problem that a designer of a fabless company has the only thing, their intellectual property, in terms of some files that they send to a foundry, and now the foundry has a full control over all these intellectual property to fabricate it. There is an asymmetric relationship between design house and the foundry now, because the design house has only their intellectual property that they send. The foundry has all the GDSI files, the test vectors, and everything else related to the chip. There is an estimated $1 billion a day loss in IP piracy, which according to VSIA is 90 to 95% hardware. And the numbers are increasing by 20% every year. So software piracy, which has been studied a lot, is only 10% of the whole piracy market. The majority of the piracy belongs to the hardware. And what is even worse is that hardware vulnerabilities really facilitate software, multimedia, and other types of piracy. Hardware metering is a system of security protocols that enable the design house to get post-fabrication control over the number of ICs being fabricated, even though the designer has already handed out the files to the fabrication facility. This can be done by passive or active control of the number of ICs, and a number of schemes has been proposed for passively controlling this, but this is the first time that an active way to control the number of ICs coming from a design is being proposed. I will further talk about how metering can facilitate new business models in IC industry, because now the relationship is becoming more symmetric. You actually get a control over the ICs that you're manufacturing. The problem is challenging is because we don't know much about what is happening in the foundries. We don't know what kind of tampering attacks they can do, and the likely adversaries are financially strong. If somebody can afford having a $3 billion fab, they can afford many other things, for that matter. And they have full access to your designs. They have all this structural specification and test vectors. And what is even worse is that once you get an IC, you really don't know what is inside. All of these things are packaged and nicely done. So it's very hard to see if your intellectual property is actually inside one of these packages, non-invasively at least. And these are intrinsically opaque. Nowadays, we have 8 to 12 layers of silicon on the top of each other. So it's even making this more opaque. Okay. So I hope I've motivated you enough that this is an important problem. Let me just briefly go through the state of the art before I go to the details of the talk. In the new technologies, there is more and more process variations. So you get a statistically different chip every time you have a chip. The idea of using the statistical differences to get IDs has been proposed. Using this statistical differences to design a smart card by getting many IDs has been proposed by a group of researchers at MIT by physically unclonable functions. But this was just solely using variability as a security mechanism. The new direction, which I'm introducing here today, is to integrate this into a higher level functionality of your design, so you actually have more knowledge and more information than what you just send to the fab, which is your layout files in your netlist and not your higher level functionality. Hardware metering has been proposed to meter the number of ICs by adding a programmable part. This has been proposed in 2001 by Gong Chu and I. And I want to make a difference now between watermarking and metering. So in watermarking, you watermark each IP and not each IC. So you watermark it so all the designs, all the ICs coming from the same design carry the same watermark. In metering, you want to mark or have given ID to each of your ICs so you can distinguish between the different ICs coming from the same design that could have this watermark or not. Okay, so what is the scenario? Active hardware metering. Alice, who's the design house, designs a chip and sends the files with some dollar amount to Bob, who's a fabrication facility, and asks for NA copies of her chip. Bob makes the chip and sends NA copies to Alice, but Bob could play it better than that and make NB extra copies and sell it in its local market. Now, what we're trying to do here is we want to manipulate the higher level functionality, which is not given to Bob, which we manipulate through the finite state machine of the design, which is not clear from the design files, to lock each of the ICs. The only person who can unlock this is Alice, who knows the higher level functionality of the design and can unlock each of these ICs. The requirements is we want to make sure that this can be integrated into the standard synthesis process, so you don't need to design additional tools to design your chips, and you can use the traditional design tools. So the key idea is, I want to show it by an example, actually. Assume that because we have the variation, the statistical variations in the design, we can have a set of unique IDs, a random binary set of zeros and ones from one chip. Now, this is a small design with original finite state machine of five states. Here, assume that I have here five random bits, which corresponds to 2 to the power 5, 32. Now, I can use five of those bits to design my original design. I have 27 states to obfuscate things. Now, because each of these designs starts in a random state, if I make sure that I have enough added states, I will randomly start in one of the added states. And this design will be locked. It will not be functional unless the designer who knows this diagram can give the key how you can actually transition from this obfuscated state to the original state of your design. Here I'm just showing global flow once again. So Alice gives the design specifications to Bob. Bob gets the locked IC. He does the regular scan chain test, scanning the flip-flops, reads them out, sends them to Alice, who calculates the key and gives the key to unlock the IC. Okay, so I just presented the grand scheme of things. There are a number of things that should be taken care of so that you can ensure a proper operation of the basic protocol I just described. You want to make sure that the probability of powering up in one of the added states is very high. And this is relatively easy to do because for every added bit, you get exponentially many more states. So, and with a relatively small k, you can make sure that this probability reaches 1 with a very high confidence. Another issue that could be more problematic is the birthday paradox. You want to make sure that no two chips start in the same state, so you cannot use the same key that you provided for the one chip to unlock the other one. Low overhead of the added states, diversity of keys, and storing the input sequence. So once you unlock something, you want to keep it unlocked so the chip is operational for the rest of its lifetime. So the basic paradigm I've just described should be implemented in hardware and should be obfuscated enough to be implementation-wise making sense. So one thing to remember is that finite state machine is the control part of the design. Finite state machine typically takes way less than 1% of the overall design. Anything, even if you make your finite state machine 5 times larger, it's not going to affect anything in your design because it's not a significant portion of the area power. The only thing that it actually determines is the delay to a certain extent. And the requirement for I presented two blocks. One was the random unique block that was generating the sequences of zeros and ones, and the other thing that I presented was the finite state machine. So let me go through the implementation details of the random unique block. For generating this, we used the very recent circuit proposed by Sue Otis and others at University of Washington, who did not use any special processes to generate the random IDs, but just used a circuit structure depending on two NOR gates to generate a random bit. So this is very good because in your regular synthesized circuit, you have a sea of gates, NANDs and NORs, and many other types of gates, so there is no way for you to tell which part of your design you're storing your IDs. They report 96% stability, one thing that really definitely needs to be done is to have error correction codes in place so you get the same code every time you power up. Unfortunately, I would not have time to go through the details of error correction code, but I would be happy to discuss it afterwards. But this is just a very small part. Remember, the 2 to the power k states coming from this k bits, so this is a very small part of the design still. Let me go to the implementation details of boosted finite state machine. So there is the requirement that you want to make sure from every added state in the boosted finite state machine, you actually have a path to the original state. The other requirement is you want to make sure that these paths are, you have enough diversity of paths so you can generate many of them. Even you start in the same state, it's not just that you couldn't tell that you've started in the same state, but it's also you're not going to generate the same path going to the original state. I'm going to talk about state obfuscation, so even if you're in the same state, you would not realize you're in the same state because I'm going to put a whole bunch of don't cares into my design. Multiplicity of keys could be easily provided, given that I have a huge graph with a lot of nodes and I can just add a few edges and the transitions could be easily occurring for the edges that I provide. We wanted to automatically integrate BFSM into the synthesis software. So now this was a very, very challenging part because traditional synthesis software is designed to optimize the states itself, and now if we synthesize all this huge finite state machine, the added part and the original part, we were getting something around 4 times overhead overall, which is still tolerable because still it would be around 1% of your whole design. But we wanted to do even better than that. So what we decided to do was to separately synthesize these two finite state machines and then merge them. The reality is, of course, we get exponentially many more states for each added flip-flop, but in reality, the truth is the logic that does the transition in the finite state machine is actually having some overhead and quickly adds to the overhead. Here is a way we did the BFSM implementation. I'm not going to go through the details. What I'm going to tell you is that, you know, if you make sure that you have a sparse enough graph that you can easily make sure, then your implementation edges that require a lot of logic could actually be implemented with a very, very low overhead. And we've used randomization of some of the regular structures to do this. And after that, we could actually fool the synthesis program that we have this one design, and we did that by adding glue logic and obfuscation states. So we used the don't cares of the design, and we added a few flip-flops to add additional states, and then we used all these to obfuscate things. So you would not be able to tell what are the states that are or your original finite state machine, and what are the states that your obfuscated finite state machine. Of course, then comes is this scheme resilient against attacks? The first attack that we consider is a brute force. You just start giving inputs and keys till you unlock a circuit. Of course, you might think that reverse engineering a finite state machine is an option. So this is definitely a valid attack that can come to mind. The redundancy removal through differential study of the chips, emulation of the random unique block, initial power-up state capturing and replaying, reset state capturing and replaying. Once you unlock a design and you get to some state, you can capture that and replay it on some others. Control signals capture and replaying. And another attack which we thought in the beginning could be a problem was creation of identical ICs. You just basically release those ICs that start in similar states. But of course, the synthesis software already obfuscates the states. So there is, even if two states are next to each other from the number-wise, they're not going to be next to each other on the graph. So this attack is not going to work. In developing countermeasures, there are two important principles. And one is, of course, that finite state machine is much less than the 1% of the overall design. And the second is finite state machine recovery has been shown on and on to be a computationally intractable problem. So looking at the netlist, there is a sea of gates. And this sea of gates where only finite state machine is only 1% of this whole sea of gates, there is no way for anybody to tell what is the high-level functionality of this design. So this problem is not addressable. And one way to obfuscate things even more is that there is not only one finite state machine on modern designs. You have multiple ones controlling multiple things, so you could easily merge them and obfuscate things even more. Another method that works well against the brute force attack is creating black holes. Basically, you add these states that go nowhere, so once somebody starts randomly inputting and adding states, they will get into one of these black holes, and there is no way for them to get out. So this, as I will show quantitatively in a bit, is a very strong countermeasure. Creation of specialized functional finite state machine. So these finite state machines, it's not just that you transition from the reset state to the original state using the transitions on the edges, but also these transitions are a function of the random unique block. So once you have the random unique block, it is going to be the transitions are a function of that. So even if you capture from one design and replay it on the other, it's not going to work because it's a function of the internal state of the design that you really don't know, and it's different for this new chip. Combinational redundancy removal is only applicable to very small chips, so this is not a valid attack. And of course, obfuscation of state activities and encoding is already being done by the synthesis software and the don't cares if we've added. Let me show a very small set of experimental evaluations on real benchmark circuit and show that how much overhead we were getting. So the overheads that I'm going to show are overheads with respect to the area, power, and delay. So this slide is about the showing benchmark circuits from ISCAS 89 benchmark set. These are sequential designs, relatively small. They used to be there has not been a lot of new benchmarks coming out, but these are very small. So, which is in some sense bad news, because the smaller something is, you add more overhead, adding obfuscation states. But even for small designs, like take S9234, a design with 36 input, 39 outputs, and 135 flip-flops, adding to the power 15 flip-flops, to the power 15 states, only added 3% in terms of the area. So it was a very low overhead implementation in terms of the area you were getting. In terms of delay, we were doing perfect. Almost no overhead, and that is because our synthesized finite state machine, because we co-synthesize it by hand, is not on the critical path of the original design. So we're actually not adding anything to the delay of the original finite state machine. The power number I'm showing is not the power number that you add to the whole design. It's only the power number. It's not the power also considering the memory. It's the whole design, but not considering the memory. And even then, you know, and memory is very power consuming, as we all know. Still, the percentage of power overhead is very small, almost negligible when you look into larger circuits, reaching 1% even for mid-sized circuits, which are the large circuits in the ISCAS 89 benchmark set. Okay, so the last set of results I'm going to talk about is we studied how, if you can do the brute force attack, guessing initialization sequences, and we set the upper limit for this just 2 to the power 15 or 2 to the power 12 added states and 2 to the power 18 states by only to 1 million guesses. And we've just shown how adding even one or two black hole is very effective against this brute force attack. You would basically get into the black holes and not be able to come out. Okay. So, in conclusion, it's very important to develop new mechanisms and methods for protecting your designs against hardware piracy. I've presented the first symmetric active hardware metering scheme, which gives the designer an active control over the chips that are being manufactured of her design. It's based on the unclonable variabilities that we integrate them into unique IDs on each of the chips. And the keys can only be provided by the designer, who knows the high-level specifications of the design. And what I've shown is a low overhead implementation, classification of attacks, and resiliency against them. Of course, this opens the avenue for much wider scope of research. Just because the higher level functionality that I've just mentioned has the potential to integrate many more security mechanisms. Basically, you as the designer have something, a secret about your hardware that other people do not have. So if you can actually integrate that into the flow of your data, flow of your programs, you could make them potentially much more secure and much more safe than they were before. And it has also a potential for broad impact on IC industry, because now you have a control and you can change actually the business model that has been in place for a while now. Thank you for your attention. And I'm...
There is time for a few questions. Please state your name.
My name is Adrian Mettler. Would I be correct in assuming that absent for most applications, absent this feature, the behavior of the netlist, if you were to simulate it on a simulator as opposed to actually fabricating it, would be deterministic, and then you could look at that and determine which elements would be the things that would be fabrication dependent. That would be sort of you'd look at the essentially would be a if you were to simulate it would be a signal that would not resolve, and so therefore it would depend on the physical characteristics of the silicon. So wouldn't it be possible to simply remove those from the design, and then you have deterministic design, and then you'd really only need to reverse engineer a single instance as opposed to having a general procedure that would be able to, given a particular, that would work for any fabricated instance?
So it's actually a very interesting question. First of all, simulating a huge design is by itself not a very simple problem. For example, Intel has farms of computers to simulate each new CPU that comes out for, and they run these farm of computers for 6 months to just even simulate one design. And the second question that you were mentioning is that these will be unresolved, but these will only be unresolved because you see, this actually goes back to what is your circuit mechanism for making these ICs. So now, if you get a simulator or emulator, you can emulate and simulate logic. But I don't know how much you're familiar with like a software like SPICE that actually simulates the analog signals. You can only go up to 50 transistors or 100 transistors on a SPICE software. Million gates? You got to be joking.
Well, the question is, if you don't have this, then, normally your logic is binary. I mean, if you don't have these non-deterministic kind of things, then you need to do analog simulation because it's not, unless it's an analog processor, it's a digital circuit.
Oh, but the thing is, okay, so it's a digital circuit, but we have reached the limits, right? So in the limit of 45 nanometer, which is the state of the art today, there are only 50 atoms in each of the transistors you have. So if people could actually resolve variation, they would go to 10 nanometer, 5 nanometer. But if you look into the roadmap that they are building, it's actually stopping and it's been saturated, and it will be saturated for the next few years just because people don't know how to handle variations. So if your question is, you can handle variation, that's the most challenging part of the continuation of the silicon industry. It's a question that millions of researchers are working on and does not have an answer. I don't think so. Well, it's actually not true. Even if you look into the designs that are out today, you see 40% variation in timing, for example, of the circuits you see. For example, you get this Pentium 3 processor, and it's running on 1.8 gigahertz. Another one is running on 2.2. It's not that these are two designs. It's the same design. It's just that after testing, they know which one was 1.8, which one was 2.2. So there is no control over that, and there is no understanding of that, if that's the question.
Okay. One more question.
Rob Cunningham from MIT Lincoln Laboratory. So my question has to do with scalability. I think in the examples that you showed, they're relatively small designs. And if I understood you right, I think you said that you hand chose where to put in the countermeasures. And so in the examples you were just giving, which were much, much larger scale ICs, I would imagine that you wouldn't want to do that by hand. So my question is, what are the opportunities for automating the process of inserting these countermeasures, and what are the implications of that?
So actually, I'm doing it by hand. It's actually being done by the synthesis software. It's just that I do the two finite state machines separately by the synthesis software, and then I add obfuscation logic by hand. So obfuscation logic is not a very big apart because, you know, as I said, with very few flip-flops, you can add many more states. Of course, my hope is also, you know, trying to have a new synthesis software that could optimize this. But the current state-of-the-art synthesis software is not designed to optimize for this particular instance. Now, you know, I actually have worked with people who are like the founders of Cadence and Synopsys and who've actually written these synthesis software. So one thing that, you know, potentially can be done is, you know, you go to these companies and tell them, you know, optimize your synthesis software for this particular thing. So I didn't have the capabilities of doing that with my few students, so I haven't considered writing my own synthesis software, but it's only a question of putting the effort to write the optimization to do that.
Right, that's the end of this obfuscation session. Let's thank the speaker again.